Welcome to the Nonviolent Jesus Podcast. I'm John, Father John Deere, and today I'm speaking with Emily Yellen, co-author of the big new memoir by the late Reverend Jim Lawson. This is a project of www.beatitudecenter.org, where you can find many other podcasts and regular Zoom programs on the nonviolence of Jesus and practicing nonviolence and working for a more just, more nonviolent world. So as we always do, I'd like to begin with just a little prayer. So I just invite you, wherever you are, just to take a deep breath and to relax, and to recenter yourself. And together we enter into the presence of the God of peace and love, who loves you personally and infinitely, and everyone everywhere. And we welcome the nonviolent Jesus here with us. And just take a moment to ask for whatever graces you need to carry on the work of peace and do God's will. God of peace, thank you for all the blessings of life and love and peace that you give us. Be with us now as we reflect together on your call to follow the nonviolent Jesus and work for a more nonviolent, more just world. Bless us, inspire us, disarm us, strengthen us, and send us out to do your will, to do our part to end racism, poverty, greed, systemic injustice, fascism, war, nuclear weapons, and environmental destruction, that we might be your holy peacemakers and welcome your reign of universal love, nonviolence, justice, and peace on earth. Amen. Well, it's a great blessing to welcome today Emily Yellen to talk about her major new book, the posthumous memoir of the great civil rights leader, Reverend Jim Lawson. The book comes out on February 17th and from Random House, and I strongly urge everyone listening to order it wherever you get your books and jump into it. It's fantastic. It's called Nonviolent, My Life of Resistance, Agitation, and Love. As some of you may know, Jim Lawson was a very close friend of mine, and I knew him for 34 years. I met him in jail in 1991, as you do, and later he hired me and was my boss at the Fellowship of Reconciliation. We spoke around the country together, went to jail together many times, and for the last 10 or so years of his life, we talked every month on the phone, right up to his death. Emily Yellen is a journalist, writer, and producer, a longtime writer for the New York Times. I think she was in the office of this, handling the South, and author of two other books. She produced a 10-part video series called 1300 Men, Memphis Strike 68, which was for The Root, which you might want to look up. She first met Jim Lawson when she was 5 years old, while attending elementary school in Memphis, with Jim's oldest son, our friend John. Emily Yellen, welcome to the Nonviolent Jesus Podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you so much for finishing this great mammoth book. You know how excited I am about it because, as I told you, I remember walking down a street with Jim Lawson in 1999 and lecturing him, as I always did, on why he needs to write his autobiography. And I was after him about that for the rest of his life. And here you are, you pulled it off.
Yeah, it was a feat, but it was a wonderful feat.
Yeah.
So I feel very lucky, and when you tell me that, I think, wow, you know, I am lucky, but I'm also lucky to know you and to hear your stories about him as well.
Well, I remember about 15 years ago, he called me and goes, "Okay, John," he had this very deep voice, "you be my co-author." But it's just so glad that you found him and he found you. So just friends in general, here's a little take. Reverend Jim Lawson was one of history's greatest teachers of nonviolence, period. One of Dr. King's best friends and advisors. And with the book, you'll go through most of his life in the civil rights movement, how he directed the Nashville sit-ins, then the Freedom Rides, then the Birmingham campaign, then the Meredith March, many other episodes, and most powerfully, how he organized or helped organize the Memphis garbage worker strike of 1968, in which he brought Dr. King to Memphis, much against the will of the staff, where Dr. King was killed. And as we all may know, Jim later, a few years later, moved to Los Angeles, where he lived for the rest of his life as the pastor of Holman Methodist Church. Jim was a Methodist minister and loved being a Methodist minister. And he did historic work in L.A., with the workers, labor unions, and immigrants, and there should be many books written about just his L.A. life. But he was teaching nonviolence and organizing right up to the very end, and I can testify to that because he was calling me with telling me what to do. So it was great fun. I thought, Emily, we could try to walk through his life, and you could talk about various episodes or however you want to approach this because there's so much, your experience of writing the book. But you knew Jim for a long time. You know, I think, feel free to tell us about the writing of the book as we go along here. But sure. I think, you know, in my conversations with Jim and my public work with Jim in conversations, he always began by talking about this moment with his mother in the kitchen.
Right.
Always.
Right.
And then what people don't realize, which I sure knew, it's just so hard to take in that Jim went to prison, faced 3 years in prison for refusing to fight in the Korean War. This is so long before Dr. King. And then that he went and lived in India. I was telling you how he told me, you know, in the first month he was hanging out with Nehru and Gandhi's mm-hmm. best friends. I mean, you see the finger of providence there. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that and everything leading up to Dr. King.
Well, I'll say this. The book, the subtitle is My Life of Resistance, Agitation, and Love. And that's very deliberate. There are four sections of the book. The first one is resistance, and it's his life, his childhood, and his life up until he met Dr. King in 1957 in Ohio at Oberlin College. So we'll start with that part. The second part is agitation, and that we made from 1958 to 1967. So it was much of the what's called the Civil Rights Movement. And then 1968 and Memphis, the strike in Memphis and the whole year has its own section. It's six chapters. And then the final part of the book is called Still Going On. And Still Going On was what Dr. King said about Reverend Lawson the night before he was killed in the Mountaintop speech. He said that Jim Lawson had always been fighting for his people. He got kicked out. He went to prison. He got kicked out of Vanderbilt, all fighting for the rights of his people. And he's still going on fighting for the rights of his people. And so we thought that 50 years after King died, that he got to live and King did not, they were the same age, that's really still going on. And obviously the double meaning, you know, Reverend Lawson was still going on, but the same issues were still going on. So that's kind of an overview. But let's start with resistance, which the book has as 1928 when he was born to 1957. And it's the very first line in the book was a story that he tells when he was 4 years old. The very first line of this book called Nonviolent is, I punched a white boy in his face, or I smacked a white boy in his face when I was 4 years old. And I asked him, well, what does this book need to be? And he says, I want it to show that people can transform, that places can transform, that nations can transform. And so starting with this nonviolent icon, punching somebody for calling him the N-word, that seemed like a good place to start. And that happened for a couple of years. His mother and his father was a Methodist minister as well, had immigrated from Canada, and his mother was from Jamaica. So he was the child of immigrants. And they had sort of a philosophical difference. His father believed it was okay to punch some people a couple of times and that violence had its place. But his mother is the one who said there has to be a better way.
Yeah, that
and so
line.
By the time he is about we figured it out. It was probably fourth grade, something like that, or maybe a little older. Anyway, he had encountered another racist kid. Apparently, Massillon, Ohio had a few of them. And, you know, again, calling him the N-word and other derogatory names. And he hit the kid again. And that time, he hadn't told his parents, and that time he did. And there's this moment where he comes into the kitchen in the afternoon after that had happened, and he tells his mother, who's cooking, and she's looking at the stove. She's not even looking at him. And he describes this moment where, you know, she's talking and he starts hearing a voice within himself, and he heard her, and it was a very magical or you know, a spiritual moment. And that's when his mother said, "What good did that do, Jimmy? There has to be a better way." And that's really the turning point for him. And he said that from that moment on, he didn't ever hit anybody again. He didn't use violence. He was going to find a better way. And the rest of the book, in the rest of his life, is him doing that. And boy, did he do that, right?
Thank you, Emily. That is so true. And he talked about that up right to the end with me and mm-hmm. others, his mother. Mm-hmm. She must have been mm-hmm. great, really great person. But
yeah,
go on.
Well, she was very Christian and very much believed in the values that we attribute to Jesus. And, you know, if I am not by any means a Christian scholar or anything, but I even can see that, you know, what she was talking about is pure. And so much of what we hear and people take is not. And that's what I think one of the things, I know we're going to get into this, but, you know, one of the things that really just stunned me all the time about Reverend Lawson was his conviction, but also his consistency, and not a sort of blind consistency, but it came from within. It came from a deep, deep conviction, you know, a deep conviction to love.
Yes.
Real love.
Yeah.
You know?
Can
and
you say a word about the, yeah, go ahead. A word about the prison that I want to hear in India.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, it followed him, and it flows through his story in many ways. And he went to college. You know, he resisted the draft. Actually, he didn't resist the war. What he was saying when he sent back his draft card and didn't cooperate with the Selective Service was that he didn't believe in the Selective Service. He believed it was racist and that it did not, you know, that it was wrong. And so he refused to cooperate. He could have gotten an exemption. He could have become a conscientious objector. He didn't do that. He did this in the same way that Bayard Rustin had done in World War II. And so he was made an example, and he was sent to federal prison. And, you know, for those of us who are writing with and about him, he kept journals in prison, very detailed and very earnest, if I may say so.
Yeah, that some was of them, Jim.
Yeah. I read some of them to him, and, you know, it's when you're 22 years old, and he laughed at how earnest he was, you know. But at one point, he made a declaration, and it had all these whereas in them. But in one of the most stunning documents that I think we found in all of that was there was a woman that he was friends with, and he wanted it to be more than friends, and he wrote her letters from prison, and she apparently kept them, and then she donated them to the same library where his papers are at Vanderbilt. And one of the letters from 1951, he's telling her, I don't know why there can't be a movement in America, in the South, at the heart of where racism lives, that would Black people would come together and rise up, and there would have to be a charismatic leader.
Gosh.
But I know that I'm going to be part of this.
Wow.
And he said that in 1951. He knew.
He was a genius.
And
He kept saying it. Yes, he did.
You know? And then he got out of prison after a year. He was supposed to serve 3 years. And one of the conditions was he had to go abroad, and the Methodist Church promised they would send him on a mission. So he went to India.
Amazing.
And he was in India, and as you said, he met with Nehru, he met with all the people who had worked with Gandhi, and he was already very committed to nonviolence. He had been a member of FOR, the Fellowship of Reconciliation, as you know, and, you know, just coincidentally, freshman year at Baldwin Wallace College in Ohio, he met A.J. Musty, and then he had worked with Bayard Rustin and Jim Farmer in FOR things and in Methodist student movement. And so all of these people and places kind of just kept appearing before him, and he kept, you know, embracing them. And he gets to India, and he does all that, and he also travels through Africa at the time. And
yes.
Meets leaders of the independence movement,
yes.
Which was amazing.
He's so young, too, yeah.
Right, right. He's in his 20s, and it was mid-1950s. And if you ask Reverend Lawson, if you would ask him, you know, when did you meet Martin Luther King, the actual answer most of us would say is 1957 at Oberlin College. But he would always say, I met him in 1953. On the pages of the Nagpur Times. He would never say that he met him in 1957. He would say, in 1957, that was when I first shook hands with him. But he said, you know, he almost felt like he knew him before he met him, I think.
So, well, that's...
And he describes that moment when he's in India, and he's just been out. He was a coach, a football coach in India, and he'd been out playing football that morning, took a shower, came in, had breakfast, and was at his desk, and he takes the Nagpur Times, and there's an article about the Montgomery bus boycott and this man named Martin Luther King. And he started dancing and whooping and hollering because what he had been dreaming of and talking of and knowing he was going to be part of, this was it. This was it. And he was so excited. One of his colleagues came in and said, are you okay? And he said, yes, yes. And he was thrilled. And then he goes back and he decides to go to Oberlin to get a graduate degree, divinity degree. And Martin Luther King happens to come to Oberlin and do a speech about the Montgomery movement campaign, and they meet at lunch. And I said when I was writing this, I want readers, when they get to that point, instead of saying, wow, how lucky was James Lawson to meet Martin Luther King, I want people to say, wow, how lucky was Martin Luther King to meet Reverend James Lawson?
No, it's critical, Emily, because that is the way it was, because your Martin Luther King didn't know anything except he was a genius and brilliant, and he loved A.J. Musty, you know, but he slept with a gun until Bayard Rustin showed up. So he gets to meet Jim Lawson, who's already done time in prison, who knows Gandhi's best friend, who's way ahead of him, really, in nonviolence. And it was like that till Dr. King died, I think. I think Jim was Martin's mentor, and my question for you is just talk about the two of them together over the course of their lives, Martin Luther King and Jim Lawson, in any way you want. Because that's the heart of the book, really, and Jim,
well,
how he changed the world.
I think it is, but I think it's also, I will. So I'll answer your question. I think that there was a friendship there that was very deep. And I know people, you know, Martin Luther King had friends. He had a lot of friends and he had a lot of colleagues. And Jim would never claim necessarily to be in his inner circle, you know, and he didn't live in Atlanta and he wasn't a Baptist preacher, right?
Right.
And he wasn't from the South. However, his son, John, my friend, called him, I think he said it best, he said they were spiritual brothers because... Yeah. They both were third-generation clergy. They both believed in nonviolence. They were the same age. They were born 5 months apart. And they both had this deep commitment to nonviolence, to the nonviolent direct action, to nonviolent direct action, and that living it as a way of life was true for both of them. And it was sort of their North Star, I think, in terms of how to conduct themselves and how to conduct the movement. And I think the beloved community, you know, the belief in that vision also was a North Star. And that's where they really met, and that, you know, in their minds and their hearts. And that guided them. But I also, one of the first questions I asked him when I first interviewed him was, you know, what was he like? And he, Reverend Lawson, started talking about how they would play touch football together and how they both loved, you know, great food that they had been brought up with. He talked about the retreat in South Carolina, St. Helena Island, Frogmore, and that there was this shrimp. When they would go to that retreat center, there was this shrimp that was caught that morning, and it was something called Frogmore stew. And they would eat that, and they would eat it every night they were there, you know, just because it was so good, and they loved that. And he told one time about a touch football game where Martin Luther King was picking and somebody else was picking. And Martin Luther King, the first person he picked was Jim Lawson. He said, "I want Jim Lawson on my side," because Reverend Lawson was a athlete, you know, and so was King. And they both loved swimming. They loved football. And in his childhood, you see him, you know, doing all the sports, and he was a coach in India. So I think they shared a lot, you know, and they shared a real vision together.
Yes.
And that's what's so beautiful, I think, throughout the book, is it keeps reemerging.
So Jim, I mean, really could say for Dr. King, Ralph Abernathy was his closest friend, but maybe Harry Belafonte, who, you know, got the kids to school and did miracles. And maybe Stanley Levinson was the white New Yorker who was really important. But Jim was, if it's possible, more committed to nonviolence than Martin. I mean, they were absolutely the same in that. And I think more than anybody else in the movement, that's where Martin found a peer in Jim Lawson in total active nonviolence. So his statement was, Jim Lawson, in 1957, Jim Lawson is the greatest theorist and strategist of nonviolence in the world. And Jim remained so until his end. Now, there's too much to talk about, but I want to walk through some of these things and then let you say whatever, some of these moments, and say whatever you want. So one of the greatest nonviolent campaigns in the movement, and maybe in certainly U.S. history, was the organizing Jim did in Nashville, which led to the sit-ins. Now, the Greensboro kids sat in first, but the Nashville thing was a very thought-out, structured movement, and he trained Diane Nash, John Lewis, Bernard Lafayette, and many others. So there's that. And then, you know, Jim is trying to hire Dr. King. He gets on the staff of the FOR, and the next thing you know, he's organizing freedom rides, Birmingham. Jim goes to Vietnam at one point, way before Dr. King.
On a mission.
But still.
I mean, on a peace trip.
And then also the Meredith March. So, like, for example, I've been studying. So I want you to talk about Jim and the movement.
Well, let me start with Nashville. He gets to Nashville. That's where he decided to come. When he met Dr. King at Oberlin, Dr. King said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Well, I'm going to finish my degree and then I might go get a PhD. And he goes, "No, we need you now. Come south now." And Jim Lawson dropped out of Oberlin and moved to Nashville and was hired by FOR. And then he enrolled in Vanderbilt's Divinity School, and he was one of the first black students at Vanderbilt. And at a certain point, after traveling all over the South, there was such a strategy that people act like this, the campaigns just came up spontaneously and were reactive, but really they were planned. And Montgomery, but they were trying to do another Montgomery. They had to show that they could do it again, that they could desegregate somewhere else, right? And so Jim traveled all over, Reverend Lawson traveled all over the South for almost 2 years, and concluded that Nashville was the place he was living. There was already an active branch of the SCLC called the Nashville Christian Leadership Conference. And there were other people there who were already committed, and they had four colleges, three black colleges. And so he felt it was the right place. And so then they started a very important part of nonviolent direct action, which people don't really think about, which is they spent 6 months listening to the people who lived in Nashville who were living through segregation, and mostly the women of Nashville, who told them, you know, the worst part is when we go shopping and we're downtown with our children, and if we want to buy our child some shoes, they can't try them on. We have to buy the shoes, ride the bus home, put them on, and then if they don't fit, we have to come back. We have to get another pair of shoes. We have to come home on the bus, et cetera. And then, you know, obviously bathrooms were an issue. And then if they wanted, you know, they'd been downtown shopping and they had their kids and they were in a department store. There was one that had a play area for the kids and a lunch counter where they could sit and the women could sit and have coffee, the wives, the mothers. And Black women couldn't do that. The Black kids couldn't do that. They had to tell their kids, you know, you can't do that. And why? And so those were the kinds of stories that spurred them. And so it wasn't obviously just about sitting at a lunch counter, you know, it was much more. And that those stories are when they decided as a group that we're going to do this. And that's when they started organizing and recruiting students from all over the city to come and learn about nonviolent direct action. And you mentioned John Lewis. Diane Nash was a student at Fisk. She was from Chicago, and coming to Nashville, she experienced segregation for the first time, really, in her daily life. And she was outraged, but she didn't really believe in nonviolence. She just said, it was the only game in town, so I went, you know? But I think that's where Reverend Lawson really, you know, brought people in, but he also got to their hearts and got to them in a way that I don't know the words for it, but that changed people, transformed people. And that transformation element that he was trying to do all over the place, right? And so I think that's an important thing to know, is that none of this sprung up spontaneously in reaction. It was planned, it was strategic. You know, in many ways, and Reverend Lawson eventually said this, the planning and the strategy and the training and the equipping, it was equivalent to the military, but it was the opposite means and goals and everything of the military. And so I think that was a really important point that I really didn't know, I don't think, in the, you know, even though I knew something about this. And so that was Nashville. And then those people, the people that he trained in Nashville, went on to become the leaders of the movement as it went forward. John Lewis, Diane Nash, Bernard Lafayette, you know, many of them, James Bevel. And he also spoke a lot about how he tried to include women. I mean, he recognized, you know, years later, the sexism in the movement, but he sort of instinctively knew Diane Nash was a great person to put out front. And another thing about his work in the movement and his relationship to Dr. King is, you know, his main goal up until probably Memphis was to stay out of the spotlight. He and Dr. King had talked about it and said, you know, he's a strategist and he's a trainer of other people and he's, you know, an activist in that way. And that being out front and getting arrested and all of that would not allow him to do that work effectively. And so they agreed that he would kind of stay behind the scenes. But that does not mean he was not involved. In fact, when they went to Birmingham, they really agreed he's not going to march, he's not going to do anything, he's going to stay at the headquarters at the Gaston Hotel. And when Ralph Abernathy and you know, Dr. King decided to get arrested and the letter from the Birmingham jail, Reverend Lawson was at the hotel with some of the other people in the movement and, you know, working strategy. And so I think that's another aspect that just I think is fascinating when you read his account of the movement.
You know, that's one of the
different point of view.
Yeah, it's one of the many new things I learned reading that book. And I've talked so much about with Jim about his life. He was literally at the command center. He was the command center in Birmingham. But you could read some of the big famous books on the civil rights movement, and you wouldn't know Jim Lawson was there, but he was. And I also didn't know that that was a deliberate choice that he and Martin made all along.
Right. It's fantastic. In many instances. And, you know, I heard Andrew Young say a similar thing about the choices that he and Dr. King made about his role.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So that's the thing. Everybody knew that Martin Luther King was the front man. I don't know. That's a little bit of a diminishing title, but, you know, the one who was going to be out front, the icon. But as with anything, no one does it alone, right? And these are the people around him. And I think Reverend Lawson, you know, it's interesting. We've had a couple of reviews, and they've said that one said that he was modest. The other said he was humble.
That's
and,
true.
You know, yeah. I didn't actually, at first I was like, what, you know, but then I realized, yeah, I mean, that was one of his superpowers.
That was one of his, unlike anybody, he had a modesty that was amazing. Well, let's talk about Memphis then, because we're coming near the end.
Okay.
Tell us about that.
Okay. Well, you know, as I said, the third part of the book is six chapters. It's 1968. It's one of the best documented campaigns in the movement, and I say that with absolute immodesty myself, because one of the reasons for that is my parents did a oral history and collected all the film and television. They were both journalists in the moment. So it's one of the only oral histories where the interviews, 150 interviews with people involved in the strike were done starting in May 1968 through 1972. And in the course of that, they interviewed Reverend Lawson 13 times. My father did. So there are sentences in this book where half of his answer is to my father in 68 and half is to me in 2022. Which is an amazing personal aspect of it for me. But I think it also gives me a vantage point with him and the way we were able to dig down into Memphis and the newspaper coverage locally. It wasn't good, but it was a character in terms of covering the strike accurately and telling the story of the sanitation workers and their lives. But it was a part of the story and the viciousness toward Reverend Lawson, toward Dr. King. Of course, now there's all these celebrations and commemorations and everything, but that was part of the problem with the way that they were covered in the media. And that's obviously a problem we have today, but it's a little different part of it there. So this strike was 1,300 sanitation workers, black sanitation workers in Memphis, many of whom had grown up or been born on plantations and had escaped to the city for a better life. And they get there and the city treats them just like the plantation owners. And they don't have a working wage. A living wage. Many of them were on welfare, as it was called back then. And, you know, this was the same injustices. It was the legacy of enslavement, and it was the Delta in America, the Mississippi River Delta, and Memphis is sort of the top of the Delta. And these men came together, and there was one man who led them, T.O. Jones, who started organizing a union, and he started in 1962 or 3, I believe. And Reverend Lawson was right there. That was when he came to Memphis and he met T.O. Jones. And it was the first time Memphis was when the labor movement and the civil rights movement came together. The labor movement had been mostly white, right? And mostly male and all of that. And in Memphis, these 1,300 men just had it. And so they went on strike a couple of days after two of their coworkers were killed in a faulty truck. And it was because the city neglect from the city, and it's a whole story. And
it's a horrific story.
They were crushed in the back of a truck.
Because it was raining and they can't go anywhere because they're black. So they hide in the back of the trash dump.
They ride in the back of the truck.
They ride in it.
And
there was an electrical shortage because of the rain. And it crushed them to death.
Pretty much.
That's the spark of it all. And that's why Dr. King...
Well, it was the last straw.
The last straw, of course.
I think the spark was...
The whole thing. Yeah.
So anyway, that strike happens. It ended up being 65 days. It was, you know, 2.5 months almost. It started in February, went through March into April. Dr. King came in mid-March, made a speech, and one of the most famous lines of that speech for me was, he said, "It is a crime to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages." That kind of resonates today, doesn't it?
It does. Can we talk about that speech for a minute? Because that was another huge thing that I learned in the book. And tell me what you think. This is my take on it. Two things. His staff doesn't want him to go to Memphis, but Jim Lawson says you need to come to Memphis. He's organizing, which is clearly going to be the end, the Poor People's Campaign, bring all poor people to Washington, D.C. That's going to be a failure. How's that's not going to work? And Jim Lawson says, you got to come. We're having this labor strike, so that's poor people. But 5,000 people are going to come and hear you. Now, that had never happened before. He's a Nobel Prize winner. I mean, I've read of stories of Dr. King speaking in Memphis, like in 67, and 100 people would show up. And that sounds true to me. You know, in rural Mississippi it was. But, and then you tell the story that they're at the airport and Jim plays a trick on him. I'm so sorry,
right,
Martin.
So the place is Mason Temple in Memphis, which is one of the biggest venues at that time that black people can use in the South.
Right.
And he had told Andy Young and Reverend and Dr. King, he had told them that there's going to be 10,000 people. And then when they get to the airport to pick them up for this event, they had already gone to the place and people were already there. And it was more than 10,000 people. But what they said as a joke, they said, you know, we told you it was going to be 10,000 people, but it's not. And they both looked dejected. And King and Young were like, oh, and, you know, sort of disappointed. And then they said, no, it's 15,000 people.
I think that was huge for Martin. And he says spontaneously in the speech, well, I'm coming back and we're going to make this thing happen. But what I saw in your book, and maybe it was through the tapes from your father, is that Jim said it was really one of the greatest emotional, spiritual evenings of his entire life. And that it really was like being in the presence of Jesus. 15,000 people almost went into ecstasy over nonviolence and cheering, and we're going to end this. And it was in Jim's words that he was telling that.
It was a true, the community in Memphis that gathered around, and really that's what Jim was the leader of, was the community that gathered around these men. He was not a union leader. The union leaders were here from Washington and the ones in Memphis, but it was the beloved community. It was their vision, right? And Martin Luther King saw that, and that's why he wanted to be here and wanted to come here and wanted to support these men.
Yeah, I didn't really.
And you say that his staff
before.
Didn't want him here, and that is the sort of classic story. But it's not quite that simple, right?
Sure.
I mean, Andrew Young was very clear that he should come for that first speech in mid-March, you know? And then when he came and he came back and the march went wrong, that's when they said we shouldn't go back. So the third time, they didn't want him to go back that third time. The first two, they were pretty much into it, you know? That's not to say everybody agreed, but one of the things, you know, Reverend Lawson said is when they were making plans, people disagreed. So it's not like everybody said, yes, that's what we're going. Martin Luther King said, we're going to do this. And they said, yes. So the idea that they had disagreements was actually healthy. And, you know, one of the things I learned was that Reverend Lawson didn't think they should do the Chicago campaign. Right. He didn't believe in it. He didn't think they should leave and go to an urban area. They shouldn't go to the north. They were busy in the South, and that's where the worst part of it was. And yet when they went, he cooperated, he went along, and that's what the staff did. So I don't think it's quite as dramatic as people want to make it in that sense. And I think Reverend Lawson said that too, you know.
Let's talk about nonviolence then, because we're running to the end of our time. So Dr. King is saying Jim is the greatest teacher of nonviolence in the world. And I think he was that all his life. And this is the Nonviolent Jesus podcast. And a lot of our conversations, Jim and I, were about the nonviolence of Jesus. How do we practice that now? What does this all mean? All these many years after Dr. King and all that historic nonviolent revolutionary work. So I was looking for stuff in the book. And I want to just ask you generally, What can you tell us about active, creative nonviolence that you learned from working on this with Jim?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really big question, but I'm going to try and just circle in, right? It's not so much maybe what I learned, but what I think people will get from this book is, how do you live a life where you don't create harm, where you do try to live leading with love, right? And the example of Reverend James Morris Lawson Jr. is pretty much the best one I've ever seen, you know? He wasn't a saint. Some people have said he was, but he was not a saint. And he was not a sinner either, right? He lived his life, but he truly believed that no one was better than anyone else and no one deserved more than anyone else or less than anyone else. And I think that is, for me, something I've been able to do more in my life since I spent 5 years with talking to Reverend Lawson about his life, right? And writing with him about his life. I think that the idea that, you know, and I know it's probably a Christian idea. I am not a Christian, but I know that it is a Christian idea, but I think it's an idea that permeates a lot of religion and a lot of people, frankly, who maybe aren't religious like me. It's the idea, you know, the idea that you do no harm, ahimsa, right, which is the word from which nonviolence came for Gandhi. And the idea that you live your life, the way I put it is, I'd say if I had a spiritual guide besides Reverend Lawson, it would be Fannie Lou Hamer. Mm-hmm. And the idea that nobody's free till everybody's free. And as a white person growing up in the South, I really believe that's the case, and that's how I live my life, and that's where Reverend Lawson's life is such a great, it's so instructive, but it's also inspiring, you know, and it kind of is about our better angels.
Oh, that's
there. I said something religious there.
That might be a good note to end on, because it's also true. He was so inspiring, and you've given us a great gift. So I want to ask you the last thing is, have any words of encouragement for our listeners and in your hope with this book, that what people might take? I just want to tell you, and on live, that I was shocked by the title of the book, and it was so fantastic that you came up with the one word, nonviolent. Because, folks, as I told Emily about, I don't know, 14 years ago, I was in L.A., and I called Jim. I said, I'm coming. I'm going to be in L.A. I'm giving a speech, but I'm taking you to lunch, and we're going out to Malibu. I'm going to introduce you to all my rich movie star friends. He said, no, John, we're going to Taco Bell in my neighborhood. Okay, fine. It was Ash Wednesday, which is the Catholic day of Lent and, repentance. So we're sitting there, and you're two clergy people, and that's what you talk about. And I said, oh, Jim, but just before we get into it, I want to know what your plan is for Lent for 40 days. What's your spiritual program? Which is what we do. And without missing a beat, he said, and this wasn't that long ago, I'm trying to be nonviolent. And I'm going to work on it over the next 40 days. And so then you come up with that as the title. That's the real Jim Lawson. He was always working on it. And that, it's amazing. So any last thoughts for our listeners?
Well, I think Reverend Lawson got to live 56 years beyond Dr. King. They had the same vision that we've talked about. And now we're left with that, right? And the work continues. I think all of us can take up that work, and it's hard, and there are losses, and evil and tyranny can reign, but that's not an excuse to give up. It's not an excuse to stop. It is an excuse sometimes to take time and rest and tend to your inner life, and that's something Reverend Lawson was adamant about. He taught that to the Little Rock Nine, and there's a story in there about that, how he had to teach them how to have that inner core of strength and know who they were so that people can't take that away from you. So it's a tough time right now. And it can be very discouraging. It is very discouraging to see the world, but there are lots of tough times. There have been lots of tough times. One of the first revelations that I had as I was doing this book was when he said, I was asking him, like, what is nonviolence? Come on, you know, what is it? What is it? And he said, we can't imitate the evil ways of our oppressors. And for me, that was so important to understanding nonviolence, is that, you know, it doesn't mean you don't get angry. It doesn't mean you don't want to hit somebody, but violence begets violence. Nonviolence builds and can build a more loving, a more just, a more, I guess, loving again world. And that's really what he stood for. And I'm gonna ruin it by saying the last line in the book, which he said to me, and I made it the last line in the book, and I'm gonna read it to you if that's okay.
Sure.
He said, "We each must discover our own mile and join the great visible and invisible community of human beings who seek a country and a world that does not yet exist."
Well, thank you so much, Emily. That's beautiful to end on. And so thank you for the book. And all those listening, please go and order it and get it. It's called Nonviolent, the new memoir of Jim Lawson, co-authored by my guest and friend, Emily Yellen. And thanks, friends, for listening to this episode of the Nonviolent Jesus podcast. And you can hear more podcasts and find other upcoming Zoom programs at beatitudecenter.org, and there make a donation if you want to support this free work. And also sign up to receive our free e-blast, which gives out news about upcoming speakers and upcoming podcasts and Zooms. And please leave a review, but most of all, tell all your friends about this podcast, because it's terrific, with guests like Emily Yellen. May the God of peace bless you all. Keep on following the Nonviolent Jesus. See you next time.